You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Many people have a favourite show from their past that introduce them to the world of the strange and unusual. Discovering mysteries seem to be a regular source of inspiration for many of us, from In Search Of, The World of Arthur C. Clarke, 40 and TV and Unsolved Mysteries, we lost ourselves in the strange. However, in this modern era, have we lost these multifaceted shows to overly dramatic programmes with no real content? Or are there still diamonds in the Fortean skies for us to discover and inspire us? Joining me is the Fortean Times television reviewer, Stu Neville, to wade through our memories. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my two latest patrons, Patricia and Simon, and thank you to everybody that continues to support the show through Patreon. It is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So let's dive into Watching the Weird with Stu Neville. In this age of multi-channel choices and on-demand streaming services, it seems that genuine Fortean shows seem to be as rare as unicorns. Now officially known as the resident couch potato for the Fortean Times, Stu Neville returns to discuss some of the classic shows, reboots and more. Stu, welcome back.
Hello, Paul. Good to talk to you again, mate.
Likewise. Pleasure as always, my friend. Pleasure as always.
Yeah. I know. I was looking just now. It's been 9 months since we spoke to each other last. It's just, it doesn't seem possible, does it? I mean, we talk a lot on Facebook and stuff.
Yes.
You know, and so forth. But actually, sort of having a proper chat like this. Yeah, it's been 9 months. It just flies by, doesn't it?
It does. I was checking before I started and I was thinking it was, I'm sure it was a lot sooner than July, but it wasn't.
I thought it was the end of the year. I thought it was kind of late autumn at least. But there you go.
Well, these episodes are beginning to blur into one long, strange conversation, Stu. Not just yours.
That's what life is like with me generally, so
yes. Well, it's quite apt really, because obviously so Christmas just gone, somebody bought me the marvelous Fortean TV box set, which is one of those lost gems of British television that takes me back to a very special period of my life, that sort of mid to late 90s period where we all think we're indestructible at that particular part of our lives, I think, Stu. And
Definitely.
We were sat down for me and my partner over Christmas trying to watch a few, and I think she lasted 4 episodes before leaving me to it.
Yeah. Four, mate. I think one was 2. Yeah, it is. It's absolutely marvellous. And, you know, I was really, really lucky to get a preview copy last year so I could watch it and then interview the Reverend himself, which was an absolute pleasure because the guy is such an... He's just one of the nicest people you could possibly speak to. You know what I mean? He's lovely. He's exactly as he comes over. Yeah. You know, it's no change. And also, bear in mind, he's like 140 now or something. He's just like, he doesn't sound it in the slightest. He sounds exactly like he does on Fortean TV. Yeah. You know, he hasn't changed. He actually sang me one of the songs as well. He can remember all of them. He used to write the lyrics and Ulf would do the music, but it was like they'd do it on the spot pretty much each time. And he was a really interesting guy. But actually, what I was surprised at most of all was how well it held up. Mm. Apart from anything else, I was almost dreading watching it because it had been obviously 25 years since I'd seen it last.
Yeah.
You know, and I had taped it at the time, but I mean, all our VHSs went out. in the last Ives move, you know, because we got rid of the video, because you know.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, it was the first time I'd seen it in at least two decades. And but so much of it actually does hold up really well. You tend to think, the problem is, I think, because it was came from the same stable as Eurotrash, exactly, you know, as Rapido TV, you tend to think, well, actually, perhaps it was a bit bubblegum and a bit throwaway. But actually, it wasn't. It was actually very well made. And it's, yeah, and what's most interesting to me is just seeing how trends have changed in 25 years. Because you look at all the mentions in there of things like Chupacabra. You know, you hear bugger all about Chupacabra these days, or very, very little about Chupacabra these days. Bogus social workers.
Yeah.
You know, what happened to them? They were everywhere. And they said, well, but allegedly they were everywhere. You know, if you believe some people, they were everywhere. And then suddenly they've just gone, haven't they?
Yeah.
They were kind of like this mutated Men in Black, you know. But it was, not only that, but you get to see people like Shawn Manchester and stuff like that. It was, you know, I was, oh, God. I even had to ask David Sutton, do you mind if I mention Shawn Manchester? You know, because he's still going.
Yes.
We thought he'd passed away. He's not. He's still going. He's still threatening to sue anybody who mentions his name, I think. But, you know. But it holds together well, doesn't it? What did you think when you saw it?
I was surprised how much of it I'd forgotten. I have to be honest that there was lots of it. There were some bits that really made me chuckle. The hypnotising dog I'd completely forgotten about, especially the witness saying, oh, yeah, he just came over. And then the next thing, he was running off with me crisps. He must have hypnotised me. Or he's just a dog, mate. the possessed Capri in Eastbourne, I'd forgotten about that. Well, there's something that we won't hear about very often these days. I think seeing a Ford Capri driving around these days is as rare as anything, Stu.
Exactly, no, God, yeah. But however, autonomous cars you do see, you know, that's sort of an odd thing. But yeah, he told me a story about that because Fanthorpe, of course, took it for a spin on the cliff edge, you know, and they tried to stop him. The production team didn't want him to get in this car because they were frightened to death it was going to plummet off and take him with it. But it didn't happen. But there was a few times Lionel told me that he tried to push the boat a bit and they wouldn't let him. So yeah, he's the adventurous elderly chap in the middle of all these young go-getters, and they were worried about what he was going to do sometimes, which is quite sweet, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've got to look after your star, I think, if nothing else, just in case.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, because I did say to him, did you just get dragged in as being, you know, because you were noticeable and because you were quite a sort of high-profile broadcasting fortune? Because there weren't too many of them in those days. And he said, well, they'd asked around the FT offices and they said, well, why not Lionel? Because he's a natural at this kind of stuff. But it was actually a very two-way thing. And the researchers asked him a great deal, and he contributed a great deal to the script and to the general ambience of it and to the look of it. You know, so he was actually responsible for quite a lot of 40 TV. He wasn't just a front man. He was actively involved, which is something which was very, very rare. In those days, certainly, it was almost unheard of, you know, because we go back to the early stuff. Then it was always, for example, the best example of that would have been, I guess, In Search Of.
Yeah.
Obviously, that was more tightly themed. But it was very much Top and Tail, wasn't it? You get Nimoy at the beginning telling the story, Nimoy narrating, and Nimoy at the end telling us that he wasn't really sure about it. And then, of course, Arthur C. Clarke would do the same thing. Arthur C. Clarke would walk up the beach in bright sunshine, put up his telescope on the beach, looking for God alone knows what. Well, let's not speculate. And then appearing at the end to tell us he didn't believe in it, which is pretty much. And then Gordon Honeycomb do the commentary.
Yeah.
You know. didn't bother with that. But he was inventor of the telecommunications satellite. Don't forget, Paul. Oh. That's the most important thing we must mention every time.
Yeah, and his books.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's yet another example of the sci-fi 40 crossover, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, there's an awful lot, especially Star Trek, but we'll come back to that. Star Trek crosses over all the bloody time with 40 for some reason.
Yes.
Very strange. But going back to 40 TV, yes, it's very, very similar to In Search Of in that respect, except he's much more immersed. And in fact, in that respect, it's a lot more similar to the rebooted In Search Of, with Mr. Spock, Zachary Quinto, but Quinto gets involved. Quinto does interviews. Quinto's there chatting to people.
Yeah.
You know, which is an interesting thing. But we can come back to the Star Trek thing. But yeah, 14 TV, absolutely wonderful. You know, I loved it. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, like you say, I'm surprised how much of it holds up. And it also, it surprises me when we look back, because that period of sort of the mid-90s, obviously, it's when I discovered reading the 14 Times.
Yeah.
Everybody was watching the X-Files. Ufology seemed to be in its zenith.
Yeah.
And then 14 TV seemed to have been the last hurrah of that kind of show for a very long time. I mean, yes, very, very few British channels touched anything like that for the next 20 years or so. You would occasionally get the odd special or series that would turn up, Stu. I know in the most recent 14 Times you were discussing the In Search of the Yeti series that was re-shown recently, which
Bigfoot Files,
which is frightening because it's one of those shows that you don't think that how long ago it was, and then you realise it's 10 years old already, and you think
it is. Yeah, it's bizarre. And the Bigfoot Files is really interesting, I mean, because it was a proper go, a sober. Effectively, it was a wildlife documentary, wasn't it? Which bring, in a way, is very circular with the very first exposure a lot of us got to the Patterson film, which I've mentioned any number of times. I bore people to death with it, which was The World About Us in 1973. Mm. You know, and it was the monster myth or monster reality or myth or whatever it was called, which showed that the Yeti and Nessie, but it was narrated by Attenborough, so it had that authenticity to it. And then this comes along, and it's got that same sort of zeitgeist to it, hasn't it? Effectively, you know, in that it's got somebody who is a scientist. Well, it's got two scientists, doesn't it? Basically,
yeah.
So you've got a vet going around looking at stuff. But he's doing it very soberly. And then you've got Brian Sykes himself, who's really put his reputation on the line by doing it, I think, especially since the Melba Ketchum problem.
Yes.
You know, I mean, but that's started bubbling away in the background again. I don't know if you noticed. People have started talking about it again, saying, well, perhaps she was kind of smothered a bit. And I've never been sure what to make of Ketchum. All the scientists that I know go, oh, it's all, you know, it's very, very unscientific and bollocks. Whereas a lot of other people say, well, hang on, wait a minute. You know, she's got something here. But Sykes never mentioned it, did he? Sykes has never pronounced on what Ketchum had to say, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But the whole program itself is fascinating. You know, the Himalayas one, where they don't find a Yeti. They find something that looks like a stuffed baboon, which was supposed to be shot by Nazis.
Yes.
You know, it was an Indiana Jones type thing, wasn't it?
Yes.
Reinhold Messner then owned it. You know, and Reinhold Messner with his bouffant hair and his beard, and he was like a member of ABBA, doesn't he? Stood there talking about how he'd seen one across the river, but it was dark, so it might not have been one at all. Well, that's committal. Thanks, mate. You
know? Well, yeah, Messner's a strange one, because he's kind of flip-flopped for about 30 years on this particular subject. I've heard him say it doesn't exist. I've also heard him categorically state it does.
Yeah, and exactly.
I mean, I've got his book as well.
Mm.
And it's very strange that book's quite open-ended. And so I'm not sure if he's one of those people that seems to just say what he thinks whoever's interviewing him wants to hear.
Yeah, it could be.
Because it's one of those things that sometimes people seem to forget in this day and age. We've got access to interviews and information going back decades now. We can cross-reference a lot of things.
We can.
And sometimes these things are problematic. Sometimes they allow us to see that people didn't hold the positions that they claim in official organisations, shall we say?
Yes. I can't think of anybody that applies to, but yes, I can see what you might mean there.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. That's as vague as I want to be on that particular subject. And so it's interesting how sometimes you look at these kind of things. I mean, it's a very interesting talking about something like that when we're talking about 14 documentaries. Obviously, 14 TV was on Channel 4 here in the UK.
Yeah.
Who have occasionally, not often, but occasionally, obviously they did the Bigfoot Files.
They did.
They did the excellent Enfield Poltergeist documentary.
They absolutely did, yeah.
They did the brilliant London Underground Ghost one.
Yes.
Which is one of my favourite paranormal documentaries ever made. It's still, I watch that regularly. It still gives me the chills, some of that. And so it's quite surprising that they, as a kind of left field television channel, they don't do as much as you would expect. And yet we've also got Channel 5 these days who do all kinds of stuff. I mean, the Loch Ness one they did the other week was surprisingly good.
It is. Channel 5, it's funny because Channel 5, you it's weird, isn't it? It goes, I think, of all the British main terrestrial channels, it's the one that goes through the most sea changes most regularly. You know, because when it started off, I mean, you and I are both old enough to remember when it started broadcasting in 1994, 95, wasn't it? And its whole thing was that it was strip programming. It showed the same thing every single night.
Wasn't it 97?
Might be 97. Yes, it was. It's Spice Girls, wasn't it? The Spice Girls did the opening night, so yeah, it would have been.
Yeah,
God almighty, I update everything by the Spice Girls. That says a lot about me, doesn't it? Anyway.
Yes, because I know they did the countdown. That's one of the things I remember, as we were talking about, that strange mid-90s period, Stu. I remember the channel launching because we watched the countdown for the channel to come on. And then, you know, I mean, it was full of all kinds of crazy stuff. Remember that Keith Chegwin naked game show?
Yeah. God, I remember that. God, yeah. They did, but it was every single night was going to be the same thing, wasn't it?
Yes.
The news was on now. Then it was this program. Then it was Jack Doherty, I think, first of all, doing his chat show. Then it became Graham Norton doing his chat show. Mm. Then it was a film, always a film at 9 o'clock, and that kind of thing. And you could, whatever time you turned over, you knew it would be this, didn't you? Then it went to sort of like soft porn, effectively, didn't it, after 10 o'clock every single night? Not that I ever watched it then, good Lord. And then
the Shannon Tweed back catalogue.
That's it, the Shannon Tweed back catalogue, good God. It was, wasn't it? God, there were some, those were, so, oh, bloody hell, some of those were marvellous. There was one about Carly, the goddess of death.
Yes.
Who basically appeared just to shag people to death. And that's what she did. And it was like, you know, I remember watching it purely out of research, that one, a couple of times. And just to see. But yeah, but you're right. But Channel 5, then it sort of changed itself again, didn't it? Suddenly became, it got taken over by Viacom, I think, didn't it?
Yeah.
The American channel. So suddenly started getting an awful lot of good quality American sitcoms.
Yep.
And dramas and stuff like that. And now it seems to have settled into, you're right, it's a lot more, I don't know, it's more like BBC Two than anything else used to be.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's kind of strange. It's sort of, it's in both Channel 4, you're right, does kind of vacillate. But then Channel 4, in a funny way, is kind of starting to come back round to it. If you think, I don't know if you remember, Jonathan Ross used to have his own program about weirdness. I can't even remember what it's called. It was on Channel X, which was his thing. Yeah, years back. And he had his own programme on Channel 4 then about weirdness. And of course, now he's got another one about the myths and mysteries of Great Britain.
Yes.
Which started a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
I've only seen the first one up to now, but it's a bit remiss of me, but we've got a lot on. But it's funny, he's come back to it, because it's clearly something he's really interested in, excuse me, and he knows a lot about. And obviously he knows a great deal about popular culture as well. So it kind of sort of like nicely skips between the two. And I but what always surprises me is that he doesn't get his wife involved more, because she's the one who's got the real background in, well, folklore and stuff like that. She's brilliant at it.
Yeah.
Jane Goldman, she wrote Stardust and God knows what else.
Yeah.
You know, she knows this stuff. And you think, well, why don't you get Jane on? She's, you know, not saying don't be on it yourself, John, but get your missus on as well.
Mm-hmm.
Could be interesting to hear the two of them, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember his series in the late 90s, because they had a guy on from who claimed, I think, if the guy's name was something like Jeremy Banyard, that rings a bell somewhere. And he was part of the, what's the society called? Like the Aetherius Society.
Yes.
Yes. And so the original Adamski type Aetherius Society. And he claimed to be in touch with people from, I can't remember, Neptune or something like that. And he's yet another one who started giving us the Neptunian language, like that bloke who appeared with Patrick Moore that time.
Yes.
You know, I just want the people on Venus sound like, but, you know, it sounds like basically a turkey, didn't it?
Yes.
And to be fair to Patrick Moore, he just sat there and looked completely impassively at him, you know, right? To be absolutely, that's professionalism. He's just like, well, what about the fact we've landed on Venus with a probe and it's like made of sulfuric acid and so forth? Ah, they went to the wrong bit, which is just like, okay, fair play. You can't argue with that.
Yeah, very true. I mean, the Ethereal Society are quite a strange concept, because they're still going. Because I know, as we were talking about other shows that appear out of nowhere. Mm. Sean Ryder, when he did his UFO series, I have to say, I was thinking, you know, as someone that grew up with the Happy Mondays and Black Grape, So yep. I was fully aware of Sean in general, and I've seen them more times than I care to admit. However, that for me was one of the most pleasantly surprising shows I'd ever seen, because I don't know what I was expecting, Stu, but I came out of it thinking that he clearly had a far deeper understanding of the subject than you would give him credit for, because he went to a few places where you would think, well, he's probably going to embrace this, and he was very critical of some of the things that he was being shown, some of the things he was being told. There were some very strange interviews, there were some very compelling interviews. It was a very well done show that it makes you wonder why he hasn't done more of that in general, because it was really good.
It was. And he's a very engaging host. I was listening to something with him the other day, actually, just being interviewed, not about anything Freudian. But he is. He can, you know, now he can string a sentence together, you know, and he's very honest. He's very open as well. Mm. And, you know, he's not defensive in any way, is he?
No.
You know, he just says things as he thinks them, you know. And the UFO thing was absolutely, because it was like a 3 or 4-parter, wasn't it?
Yes.
And it was great. And you're right, he was, you know, now, come on, wait a minute. And he was properly talking to Pete, you know, and it was, and I love his description of his own sighting, the one over his back garden.
Yes.
That was great, because he was in bed, running with his missus, and you're sort of, no, look, it's a UFO. Yeah, that's nice, dear. All right. He's like, he's off again. He's like, just, yes, yes, that's nice, Sean. Go back to sleep, dear. He's like, no, look. It's like, marvellous. But he has a complete genuineness about him. You can tell that's not artifice. Mm. He saw something, and he saw something weird, and it's, you know, it's brilliant. It really, really interesting. Mm. Yeah, and I think you're right. We should have people like him doing more of it. I'd love to see him and Bez ghost hunting. That'd be ace.
I'm sure I've seen that in the past.
I'm sure. Actually, yeah, I think they might have, actually, yeah.
I've watched a few celebrity ghost hunts.
Yes, they did, didn't they? Two of them.
Oh, yeah, they did. Right. They did. Did they not do a Most Haunted with the Happy Mondays?
I think they did. Yes, I think they, pretty certain they did. They all get scrambled up after a bit in your brain. That's the thing. I've seen so many, like you have, so many of the bloody things. You forget after a while which ones it was. You know, it's like old episodes of Scooby-Doo after a bit, isn't it? Isn't that the one? Oh, no, it wasn't. Was it Mr. Peevely, the janitor, this? Oh, no, it's the librarian, this one. It's the same sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and then you go, yes, you're absolutely right. But because those two clearly have such a symbiosis.
Mm.
You know what I mean? They're not there trying to trick each other, are they? And it's good to see double acts doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
Especially ones who've been through that much, because they don't care.
Yeah.
You know, they just say what they think. You know, you're not going to get the Gallaghers on doing it, because that would be too far. You know, well, you wouldn't get them in the same room anyway, would you?
Not at all.
You
know what I mean? No.
But they just diss everything. But those two, if they saw something, they discuss it and they talk about it. And, you know, and it's funny, this interview I was listening to with Wider the other day, not particularly for him, but he said about Bez, and it's how the Mondays got together in the first place. And he said, then, how did Bez come in? He said, well, Bez came back from, I don't know, Borstal or Magaluf or wherever it is he'd been. He couldn't remember. Bez had no idea where he was for 18 months, and he just turned up in a band and says everything. But it's a sort of, yeah, that's what I like about the guy. You know? He says it as he sees it, if he can remember it.
I mean, when it comes to this particular subject, do you think that we're spoilt because we look back on the two titans of this for both sides of the Atlantic? Because obviously, as we've mentioned, we've got In Search Of, the American one, which, to my shame, Stu, I was fully aware of it. I knew of it, and I hadn't watched an episode of it till about 2018.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those programs, it's so hard to find.
Yes.
That the only way I eventually tracked it down was I stumbled across it on YouTube, which obviously it shouldn't be there, as far as I'm aware. So it's one of those programs. It just seems so ridiculously hard to get hold of. I don't even think the box set was ever released in Europe that came out about 10, 15 years ago.
Nope.
And so you've got that one, which obviously whenever I speak to a lot of American guests, they will always refer to In Search Of and certain episodes of it. I mean, the one I always, that stayed with me since I watched it, was one of those episodes that covers a very Fortean subject, really, which occasionally pops up on certain shows these days, which is the wonderful and intriguing story of Count Saint-Germain. And that's always stayed with me, along with some of the... And that was a real sort of hodgepodge where it went after all kinds of strange, you know, episodes about killer bees and then the bee avalanches and then Bigfoot and then Nessie. And then over here we had the Arthur C. Clarke trilogy, your Mysterious World and then Strange Powers. And then 10 years later, for some reason, they did Mysterious Universe, which is another one that's as hard to track down as Hen's Teeth.
You can't find it at all. I can remember so little about it, probably because when it was on, it's when I was a student. And so by that time, even though I was still into the 40, and I was more into other things, you know, by that point. Because I think, right, the sweet spot, I mean, Mysterious World was out when I was 1981, so I'd been about 14, 15. So that was about the right time for me because I was like early teens. So, and it was on a good time of the evening, and you know, and so I got to see it. The point I always make about this stuff is that we didn't have videos. None of us had videos. So if you didn't see it at the time, you never see it again until it was repeated. You know, you just didn't, you know. So, I mean, again, I always give you an example of the Patterson film. In the first 10 years, I saw it three times. You know, now we forget, you're right. You are absolutely right. We are kind of spoiled because we have access to all of these things at our fingertips, including old episodes of In Search Of. But most things now, if you look in, you look hard enough, you will find them. You know, even if you're prepared to pay a quid or two, you'll find them. You know, it's not like the old days where you had to import things. And for example, I remember my dad was an avid jazz record collector. And I remember him ordering stuff by mail order from obscure magazines, like these obscure 12-inch albums. From like front, and they cost him about 30 or 40 quid or something ridiculous. And he sent a check off, and 4 months later, a package had come back, you know, with an album in it. And that now we can literally just go online and go, all right, PayPal, £1.40 and watch it. And you're right, we forget this. We forget how much an event watching certain Mysterious World was, or even Mysterious Universe, because, we probably did have a video by then, but, you know. We would have been taping something else, not Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious Universe. You know, that's if you remember to set the bloody thing, so probably at the pub. That sort of thing. But it's, but as a result, I think these things were made to be watched. They weren't meant to be skipped. And I think this is an important point that I've raised a few times. Now you've got a fast forward button. Now people can record things. More people now, I was reading something just generally about TV, not just about 14 TV, but generally with TV, people record things and start watching them halfway through. And the reason they'll do that is, for example, if you're watching a Sunday night ITV detective drama, if you start watching at 8:30, you can fast forward to all of the adverts. You'll still watch it. You'll still finish at 10, but you won't have to put up with the adverts. So people start watching at 8:30. Now, that's never an option we had back then. You know what I mean? You couldn't freeze the telly. You know, if you needed the loo, you had to just sit there and suffer or risk it.
Dash. Well, you'd time it for the commercials, usually.
Oh, totally.
You'd cross your legs.
Ah! I know. Yeah, the Coronation Street thing, you know, and literally the National Grid would go to meltdown, wouldn't it? Because the kettles went on. Absolutely. You know, it's that kind of thing. But yes, you were absolutely right. But these things were events, and they were incredibly well crafted. They were made very quick. They were made no, they weren't made quickly. They were made slowly and with a great deal of care, because they would then want to do the later book sales, and then the book sales had to it had to justify later then VCR sales, and all this kind of stuff. So they were made to be watched. Now things are just chucked together because they want another series next Wednesday. You know, and they will just hurl them together. And there's just not the care in it. So these things were very well crafted and over a very, very long time as well. And quite often they throw a great deal of money at it. Now, if you look at something like Most Haunted, there's probably, because I know Christian Jensen-Romer was on the first couple of series, and he, there was literally 10 people maximum involved in making that. In Search Of, there's probably 100 people involved all told. You know, because they had a network behind them. So they had one camera crew off here doing this bit, another camera crew off there doing that bit. It wasn't one camera crew doing the whole lot. It was 3 or 4 camera crews, you know, and then stitching it together. They spent money on it. And it shows. It holds up now if you watch it.
It for me, it's very surprising that in this day and age that we don't have anything that compares to those kind of programs that covered a wide variety of topics. You will see programs these days, Stu, that either talk about cryptids or UFOs or ghosts and the paranormal.
They're very monastery. I don't know if you probably noticed a couple of months ago, actually before Christmas, I think it was, I put a thing on about how many people read the Reader's Digest book of strange stories and amazing facts, just to see how many people remembered it, because it was very much a 1970s to mid 1980s thing. It was a really popular book, and loads of us read it. Had it. I've still got a copy of it.
Yes, me
too. I know I've still got a copy. But that's exactly what it was like, wasn't it? That is very much the same. It goes from people being cryogenically frozen, through Bigfoot, through werewolves, through Kaspar Hauser, through, you know, coincidences and God knows what else. And it does it, but it's brilliant. And it's kind of got, it's put together in a very lucid and very, very sensible way. Mm. And I think this is the secret to In Search Of and Mysterious World, in that they actually made sense. It wasn't, they tried to recapture it, I've said before, with Schofield's Quest. And Schofield's Quest was rubbish.
Yeah.
Because what it tried to do is it would try in 8 minutes to examine an entire Fortean field.
Mm.
And like the ghosts one was absolutely risible. Basically, it was, look at these pictures of ghosts. Are they ghosts? They might be ghosts. What are ghosts? What do ghosts do? Da la 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 la. After break, we're going to look at UFOs. And straight to an advert for some Weetabix.
Yeah.
That was it. It's kind of really, please, you know, come on. And it was so badly handled, you know. Whereas Mysterious World gave a whole program to it, but it was still, you're right, it was a magazine, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just each week it would light on something. It gave it enough time. I think Mysterious World possibly suffered by only being half an hour long. Yeah. Had it been 45 minutes like In Search Of, they could have got quite a lot more.
Mm.
Whereas 45 minutes is the right length for something like that. I think once you get to an hour and a half, you're struggling quite a lot of the time.
Mm.
You know, and you notice this with, for example, Finding Bigfoot. They did a reunion a few weeks ago. I don't know if you've seen it. It's out on Discovery now. They actually all got back together, and they're all looking older, obviously. And Bobo has lost about 9 stone.
Yeah, he has. He decided to revamp himself and get back to what he was.
Absolutely, you know. And he's looking good. He's looking much healthier, I must say. And Moneymaker's got short hair now and a moustache.
Yes.
And he looks a bit like Ned Flanders. I hate to say it without the glasses, but hey ho. He's kind of and they all go off looking for squashy bit. They still did exactly the same, but it's an hour and a half long, and I can honestly say, much as I love it, I was by about the 55 minute mark, I was kind of looking at my watch thinking, we know you're not going to find anything, because in our field of interest, if you had, we'd have heard about it by now. And besides which, you're my Facebook friend, and you'd put something up about it, and you haven't, so presumably. You know, so you know, they yeah, and they pushed it. It's kind of jumping the shark in a way, isn't it? But it's, I think half an hour is too short, an hour is too long. I think you need the 45 minutes is the sweet spot. Just enough time, which, of course, immediately coincides with how long American networks like to put things on for, because it gives you a quarter of an hour adverts then.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, it is one of those weird things, because when you're talking about things like that, I mean, there are very few cryptid shows I'll bother watching these days, because a lot of them are just not very good.
No.
I mean, there are a couple of particular programs when we're talking about shows that are doing things which for me are two of the worst programs I've ever seen.
Mm.
And without wishing to give either of them any credit, one's an American, I mean, it's basically the same program, but over here it's called Unexplained, Caught on Camera.
Yes.
It has to be one of the most clickbaity television programs I've ever seen. I mean, they'll show you a picture, they'll show you footage of a meteor, and they'll go, what is this strange light in the sky? Is it a UFO? Is it aliens? And you're like, it's clearly a meteor.
Yeah, exactly.
What is going on? And they'll show well-known hoaxes, and they'll try and pass it off as stunning evidence. And you're just like, what on earth? How have we got to this point? Because occasionally, the problem with shows like that is that there will be a diamond in the rough, but it's surrounded by so much rubbish that either you'll dismiss it because of the contents of everything else, or you'll just You'll have glazed over by this point, going, oh, no, another demon.
Yeah. No, well, this is the thing. Look, these things are very, very good at capturing cultural zeitgeist. And this is one of my big things. I'm very much into the cultural impact of Fortiana and how it mirrors. It doesn't shape culture, but it mirrors it very, very effectively. And the problem is things like that are pure TikTok generation, aren't they? It's a case of you've got an – we will assume you have an attention span of 1 minute. So we will show this thing and we'll go, what is it? What is it? What is it? Well, let's show you something else. You know, and it's kind of – and it's quite irritating in that respect. And as you said, especially when it's stuff that's quite obviously explicable. And we're sitting there going, well, come on. It's, as you said, it's a meteor. That's quite obviously a tree stump, you know, and so forth. And they show hoary old ones as well that we all know damn well what they bloody are. But it's kind of this – it doesn't give anybody any sort of critical faculty, does it? It doesn't bless it. It doesn't sort of like consider that anybody watching it is going to have a mind of their own. Mm. And in a way, they're always patronizing in a way those things. Yeah. And they are irritating because they take up time that you think, well, perhaps somebody else for the same money could have spent. It's effectively like watching You Being Framed, isn't it?
Yes.
Effectively. Yes. You know, except You Being Framed, you know someone's going to fall in the water, and they do fall in the water, and that's fine. You know, but it's kind of, you know, these things, is like, oh, I mean, yeah, there's certain things that we know are going to happen. It's like, you know, remember you've always said when you're a publican, you know sometimes glasses will move across a bar on their own, yep, because they're aquaplaning along, aren't they?
Yeah.
Changes in temperature, whatever. Glasses occasionally smash because they've been, yep, taken out of a dishwasher. They're red hot and somebody's poured cold water in them. Bang, they will blow up.
Yep.
It happens. Happens in pubs. I mean, you're a publican. It happens in pubs probably at least once a week, doesn't it?
Yes. It's the least paranormal thing I think you can ever show as evidence of a, yep, poltergeist living in a pub is either a sliding glass or an exploding one. Because, like you say, my fingers in the 90s were lacerated, yeah, by exploding glasses. And they would. You'd just put them away and you'd leave it. And then an hour later, want to blow up because it had just got a weakness in it that it, yeah, was expanding, contracting, and it had just pop.
Exactly. When I was a kid, my uncle was a publican, and I used to do glass collection for him on Saturday night. And the same thing would happen. You know, you wouldn't stack them too high, but that one in the middle would just shatter.
Yeah.
No obvious reason for it. Just bang, just would just go. And you're right. It's... You know, these things, they are liquid. That's the thing. Glass is actually a liquid, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so it actually behaves like a liquid. It doesn't behave like a solid a lot of the time. And you heat it up and suddenly cool it down, its molecules change and it's then they will go. I mean, I really do like proper intensive investigations of stuff. There was one I was watching a while back. I can't quite remember which one it was, but there was a museum artifact. I think it was in New York. And it was in the Egyptian display. And anyway, it was a figurine of a god. And within the cabinet, it would turn,
mm,
very slowly. But you might remember this. And it would kind of just turn. And nobody could get at the thing. It was locked away. It was valuable, you know. And quite a lot of time, it was at night. There were people there with the security guards, the CCTV. It wasn't going fast enough for anybody to see it turning, but it would be 90 degrees, you know, by the morning. And they couldn't work out what it was. And eventually they did work out what it was. It's because this building was directly above the subway line, which would, at night, carried almost like a kind of freight or mail or something like that. So the trains were heavier. So the trains caused more vibrations. And as a result, the thing would move. And that was it. You know, it's that simple. But a good program would look at it, investigate that, and say, this is what it is, which is fabulous.
Yep.
The bad programs go, look at this. It's this thing. It turns in the night. It does. Blah, 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 blah. What is it? It's cursed. It's a demon. And you're right. The demons start coming out. And this is the point, because it does reflect the culture. At the moment, American culture is all about bloody demons. They're obsessed with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's no longer a ghost. It's no longer a poltergeist. It's a demon. Everything's demonic. It's an odd thing. I was talking to Peter Laws about it a while back, because obviously he'd been a man of cloth.
Yes.
And he said, but it's always been the same. Generally speaking, in American churches, they've long had this absolute thing about good and evil. And anything which isn't so holy is evil. You know, anything supernatural which isn't can't be ascribed to God must therefore be demonic.
Hmm.
You know, none of it's neutral. It's this odd thing. And that's an interesting way of looking at it. And it's always been there. The thing is, the American culture is a lot more, is actually a lot less, how can I put it, I'm not going to say as a country, we're, you know, as a nation, as a society, I think we're a lot more agnostic. We're a lot less religious. Mm. The American one is actually still relatively religious. And certainly we know when we lived over there, you know, far more people went to church and far more people were surprised that we didn't go to church or that I didn't go to church. And I think as a result that, you know, I think pastors in the U.S., pastors in the U.S. have a greater influence on societal thinking than we tend to remember. Mm. And these are all things you got to think about in any form of Fortean investigation. You have to look at the wider culture that surrounds the phenomenon, you know, and surrounding the phenomenon is people who think it's demons, then they're going to immediately think it's evil.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. We just tend to think, okay, it's a ghost. They think it's something that must be ridded because it's evil. Yeah. And it's kind of a malign influence. We don't tend to think of them as malign. We just think of them as ghosts, don't we?
Well, yeah, and it's something I've spoke with several people over the years, Stu, that I think that's a very important thing to quantify there because you don't really, I mean, even if you compare certain states, they're like chalk and cheese in regards to this matter, I think. And people often sort of assume America is the same from top to bottom, which it clearly isn't. Absolutely. It's not even the same state to state, as I say.
No.
Which is great, you know. Variety is indeed the spice of life.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those, as you say, you've got to be very careful of tarring everybody with the same brush or presuming everybody thinks the same because it doesn't work like that. When you try, especially if you try, people will often say how similar the UK and US are, but they're vastly different on a lot of aspects as well. And that was the point we were making about this, that I'm surprised to see how it immersed in that kind of thought process certain investigators in the US are, whereas over here we were kind of brought up with this impression that ghosts were just meandering spirits mooching about in a variety of stately homes and castles, Stu.
Yeah, totally.
People.
No, absolutely right. But you look at the difference in, you look at TV dramas, for example. Not look at documentaries or anything like that, but TV dramas. And you look at the difference between the way, for example, compare the Stone Tape or something similar. The Stone Tape, being a British investigation, is a bloke in a V-neck sweater and a tie and a tweed jacket, smoking a pipe, saying, "I say, what's that?" You know, whereas in America, they'd be sort of like drawing a gun and sort of like, "It's a demon! Exorcise, everybody run!" But if you look at the best thing to show the difference between the two, if you like, to me, was The Haunting, the 1963 Haunting, the one directed by Robert Wise, who had the most eclectic of all CVs of any director ever.
Yes.
You know, but God, I mean, he made The Day the Earth Stood Still, he made The Haunting, and he made The Sound of Music.
Yes.
Like, this bloke, what a man, you know. Directors are something we'll come on to because directors are interesting. But the Haunting still is, to me, one of the most frightening films ever made.
Yes, the original, certainly.
Yeah, the original, the 1963 black and white one.
Yeah.
Deliberately in black and white. Could have made it in colour, but no, black and white, deliberately. And because you see nothing, absolutely nothing, everything is heard or implied.
Yeah.
And that is what is fabulous. And then when they remade it, Jan van Bont, whatever his name was, who made Twister, remade it, didn't he, about 1999 or something like that, and showed everything, and it completely ruined it.
Mm.
You don't want to see it. You know, this is the point. It's the subtlety.
Yeah.
But Wise made it. He set it in New England, but it was filmed here, wasn't it? Using British text.
Yes.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
You know, it's that degree of subtlety and that degree of calmness, I think, makes a difference. And you can see this, you know, and it's only recently that American TV in particular has started being subtle. Good American TV now is fabulous. Yeah. I've got to say,
yeah,
you know, it is absolutely brilliant. British TV is getting better again. It went through doldrums a bit, but in terms of Fortean TV, American TV is. I love it. I slag it off an awful lot. No, I do, but I do love it. I'm very affectionate to it, especially stuff with William Shatner in it.
Yes. Well, I was gonna say, when we talk about this dearth of stuff, obviously, I think it'd be a glaring omission not to mention both Shatner's The Unexplained.
Yes.
Which is one of those programs that I can't think of anything else outside of Unsolved Mysteries these days.
No.
That covers something that you wouldn't normally expect to see. And there are occasions when, I mean, I watch The Unexplained all the time, regardless, because even if, you know, there are certain episodes it'll be recording and I'll go, I don't want to know about the Knights Templar. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
But even as a man who's sat through 8 seasons of Oak Island,
yeah,
and will continue to do so, I don't know why. That's my secret addiction, I think it is.
Well, it's I'll tell you why that is, because I'm exactly the same, Paul. It's the money pit.
Yeah,
it is the money pit. It's lost. It's like lost cost fallacy, isn't it? Whatever it's called, sunk cost fallacy. We have invested this much time in it. We have to keep watching it.
Yes,
because if we don't, we'll have wasted all our time. Yeah. And it is a money pit. That's exactly what happens.
Well, it is one of those things, because as we were saying about the original In Search Of. Has an episode devoted to the money pit, which is quite odd looking at that, what it was thought about 50 years ago to what it is now and what's going on there. And obviously, clearly something strange has been happening there. Whether there is a hidden treasure on that island, I'm not sure, Stu, but there's clearly lots of other weird things.
I made the point in the column that I wrote about it. I said, the thing is, when we first started, and again, it's in the Strange Stories and Amazing Facts Reader's Digest book. And at that point, it was like a 10-foot by 10-foot shaft, wasn't it?
Yes.
With a ladder running down the middle of it. And they kept finding wooden planks and platforms, almost like Super Mario.
Effectively. Yes.
And then they find something and there'd be a chest and then it all get flooded and it all vanish. And there was a human hand spotted at one point, wasn't there?
Yeah.
A severed hand. And it's like, oh God, it's all piratical. But now you look at it and then these two brothers bought the place and now they've dug a hole that's bigger than the bloody island. Effectively. It's kind of like, you know, well, as soon as they started bringing in, like, you know, industrial drag lines, and effectively what they got now is an open cast coal mine in it.
They're
going to keep going until they get to the centre of the earth.
Well, I mean, this is the thing, because I've seen people who have dismissed it a long time ago as just being a sinkhole. But clearly, watching that, it's obviously not a sinkhole.
It's something engineered. Yeah. It genuinely is engineered, isn't it?
There's lots of strange things that have gone on there, like the old dock that they found on the beach, and they found, you know, ornaments and bullets and all kinds of weird things all over the place. So it's a strange one. So, you know, the Laginas have clearly, I mean, obviously, I think it's Marty, isn't it, who's actually, he made his money in mining. So if anybody's going to know how to dig something up, it's going to be him.
Exactly. It's not two guys. It's people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's another reason we invest in it, isn't it? Because they actually understand this stuff.
Yeah. So it's still one of those things I remember reading about it as a kid, and that still interests me. But coming back to Shatner's show, it seems to be the only one that covers a variety of odd topics that the other shows just either won't touch or won't cover.
Yeah.
And I have to say, they did an episode a couple of years ago about cults, which for me was one of the best episodes of any kind of Fortean strange subject I'd seen anybody do in the last 10 years. It was surprising in its depth and its balance and its emotional suppression. It wasn't going, oh, look at all these weird people. Very, very respectful, because especially when you're talking about things like Jonestown, people can sometimes look at it completely wrong and not look at the incredible human toll that occurred there, and the whole sort of perfect storm of something awful is going to happen here. It's just a question of when.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think the Shatner stuff is interesting because he's there as the draw. But it's actually, you look at the way it's, as you say, the way it's researched, the way it's scripted, it's really smart.
Yeah.
It's very cleverly done. It's very cleverly put together. And okay, he's a bit, so he's a jocular host, but he doesn't take the piss out of it. He takes the piss out of himself. And that's what Shatner's gift has always been.
Yeah.
He does take the piss out of himself. So, I mean, it's that one, isn't it? Is it Unexplained when he's got the background, animated background a lot of the time? And he turns around and he engages with it, you know, and stuff like that. And but he doesn't overdo that. It's fun, it's gentle. But then the actual subject matter itself is properly dealt with. And it's interesting and it's brilliant. I love the Crystal Skull episode. Was great. you know, and they kept talking about the you know, obviously Arthur C. Clarke was what our first thought as soon as you see that thing. Yeah. But then is that they refer to it as the Mitchell Hedges one. It's the, and now the age by which I think Mitchell Hedges sounds like a defunct cigarette brand. Yes. You know what I mean? It's just like they sponsored this skull like they would an old Formula One car. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the Mitchell Hedges skull. And they mentioned Indiana Jones. And I thought, oh, please don't mention Indiana Jones as a historical source. But they're not. They just sort of say, oh, it's shown up in popular culture in this way. People are aware of it and stuff like that. But in that one, he's also talking about the carbon and stuff like that, the mysterious stones. So it's not many would take the leap between the Kaaba and crystal skulls, but they are mysterious stones.
Yeah.
It makes sense. It is actually a sensible thing to do. And I think what we lack, and you're absolutely right when you say, well, we haven't got strings anymore. What we've got is single subjects that they do to death. Yeah. They focus on to death. Is we don't have the scaffolding.
Mm.
So what we don't have anymore is things where people are interested in this and then say, okay, if this is good. If you like what we've done with this, watch this next week. You might not have heard of it, but it's quite interesting, you know, which is what the kind of thing you need. It's what BBC Six Music used to be really good at that.
Yeah.
Did you ever used to? How many different cultures and media are we going to touch here, Paul? Don't you ever used to listen to Phil Jupitus on Six Music?
Yeah, I used to listen to Six Music regularly.
Yeah. And he played something. Well, he said that was brilliant. You know, you knew about this one. Tell you what, if you like that, listen to this.
Yeah.
And he would, and you'd think, oh, actually, and you hear about something you've never heard of before. Mm. And that's really good. You know, and in fact, Peel used to do the same. It's quite, you know, obviously, but. I think what we need is things in 14 TV that do the same thing. Mm. And they don't just go, right, this week we're going to go, for example, we're going to go to Delaware and look for Bigfoot. Didn't find him. Right, we're going to go to Maine and look for Bigfoot. Next week we're going to go to Ohio and look for the Grassman, which is a sort of Bigfoot. And we're going to do this, this, and this. Instead, they say, okay, let's instead go to Champlain and look for Champ. Let's instead go to Puerto Rico and look for Chupacabra. You know what I mean? Which is what Josh Gates tried to do.
Yes.
And then Josh Gates has expanded out since. And I think he's much under, you know, people ignore Josh Gates. And they shouldn't. I think they, you know, he does really good stuff. Josh.
Well, I don't understand why he is, because I love his work. I've always enjoyed him. He kind of did a lot of monster chasing in that episode and went to places. I've mentioned this a couple of times on the show, Stu, that he's another one. I think, because he's got a profile, he's able to go and do things that other people won't touch. He tends to go abroad a lot. I mean, our mutual friend Adam Davis has appeared on a couple of episodes. They did a brilliant hunt for the Yeti on his show as well. And obviously Gates is one of those people that is convinced something's out there because he's seen something. He doesn't know what it was. You know, and he's found a footprint, but he's convinced that there's something strange out there. I've seen footage that they've shown from Japan where that you know, you would never see that normally on a mainstream UK or US show. But obviously, the way Josh does stuff, and obviously, I mean, I think his current series, he's got two on the go at the moment.
Yes,
because he's obviously got his monster mystery show that he does.
Yeah.
With the two hosts working in tandem with him.
Yeah.
And then he's also carried on with his other, I've forgotten the bloody name of it. What's it called now?
I can't remember.
Well, Destination Truth was the old monster show.
Or Monster Hunter, which is what they called it over here.
And then is it Expedition Unknown?
Could be Expedition Unknown. I do you know what? I'm terrible. Unless I write, I've got to the age now, unless I write things down, I forget what they are. It, you know, this includes my children, amongst other things. It's kind of like, but yes, I know. I was watching one the other week. I think you might be right. It's Expedition Unknown. But the thing is, it's what I've always liked about Josh is his absolute honesty. In the first Yeti episode, Destination Truth on Monster Hunter, when they were, I don't think, was Adam in that one? I can't remember. Anyway, they filmed a figure going up a slope. Away from the base camp, and it was in FLIR, it was in like infrared, and they said, look at this is an upright figure moving out. And then to the absolute credit said that was a Sherpa. We know it was one of the bearers going up to the base camp. And that brilliant, that I thought, you've got me, mate, that's perfect, thank you very much for telling us that. Because had that been a lot of other series, they'd have just left that completely ambiguous.
Yes.
They wouldn't lie They wouldn't. They just would never mention it again. Yeah. There's an episode of Finding Bigfoot where they approach a figure in a field, and it's an upright figure, and it's obviously alive. And Bobo's going towards it, and they go, "Oh God, no, no, careful, careful, careful!" And then they never mention it. And Matt Moneymaker, they said it was a horse. It was a tethered horse in a field. But the way it was edited together made it look like there was a mysterious figure there. It wasn't. It was a horse. But it's pitch dark. There's no artificial light. They're using, you know, they couldn't tell what it was till they got close to it, you know. Whereas Josh Gates would have said, "Ah, it's okay, it's only a horse," you know. And that I like. I think just it's fine to be honest. Yeah. I think that the problem is with Fortean investigation, generally speaking, is that it's a lot of bugger all happening most of the time. Mm. You know, a ghost hunt. You've been on ghost hunts. I've been on ghost hunts. I've been on UFO watches, all that kind of stuff. And it's a lot of being quiet.
Yep.
In the dark.
Yes.
And it's nothing happening.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't make riveting telly, unfortunately, so they have to dramatise it. But, you know, there's an awful lot of... I mean, it's... But then again, to wind it back to, say, for example, the Bigfoot files, that was good. There's a tremendous... the Bigfoot itself... Well, actually, no, the Amnesty episode's very interesting, isn't it, that one?
Yes.
You know, because, again, they work out what Zana was, and Zana was a sub-Saharan African.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, and it's like, and everybody, you know, we oh, God, well, okay, was she, like, you know, sub-Saharan? Okay, was it an earlier version of man? No, sub-Saharan African.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, and there was no frills. And the fact that the Yeti DNA, so to say Yeti DNA they got, was actually a polar bear.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all polar bears used to live there. But this one's obviously there a lot more than you think it is. But,
yeah.
You know, it's great. You know, that's fabulous. I was chatting to Rich Freeman about that. He said he's just as excited about the fact there's a relict polar bear in the Himalayas as the fact there might, great. If there's a Yeti, fabulous. There's probably both of them. Great, let's go for that.
Yeah.
But we do know this was there because we've got the evidence.
Yeah.
And that's really, really good to see. The Bigfoot one of the Bigfoot files, there's a lot of tree knocking. But then they're honest. They say, well, we think this is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, there's too many programs take tree knocking as being absolute evidence of something. But it could be a woodpecker. It could be, a lot of the time, other people trying to find big feet by hitting trees.
Well, yeah, that is something I've broached on a recent episode where, you know, there have been occasions where people have been calling out to each other.
Yeah.
Because you've got two groups of people out hunting in the same area. They've no idea each of them are out. And it wouldn't be the same with tree knocking.
That was last week, wasn't it? That was last week, I think, wasn't it? Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, as we were saying, with Gates, though, he's another one. He's obviously got a wide interest in a lot of different things. His show, along with Shatner, it's quite strange that two people who are often people, as you say, some people view both of them down their noses, which I don't understand, especially Gates. I find him a very warm and engaging personality who's clearly a deeply passionate man. He's an educated man as well.
Yes.
And so he will go. I mean, I remember him doing an episode on something called The Secret, which I was never aware of what this thing was. And it's this worldwide puzzle game set in the States where somebody had written this mysterious book, which is obviously very similar to the incident that we had over here. Was it Masquerade?
Masquerade Kit, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got given Masquerade for my 40
years.
Yeah, and it's And I think it was a massive thing with Kit Peddler.
Yes.
That's the guy, wasn't it? And he made the hair. And Bamber Gascoigne knew what it was and where it was.
Yeah, and that was
stuff
it.
Like that. And it's turned into a bit of a scandal since, hasn't it? I don't know if you heard about that.
No.
Yeah, no, apparently. Well, what? There was something about whether or not Peddler's ex-wife was connected to the man who found it. So Peddler had buried this thing. It was under a monument to Henry VIII, wasn't it? Somewhere in Cambridgeshire, I think. And that's where it was buried. But anyway, the guy who found it, in the end, it was found, had some connection to Peddler's ex-wife with whom he'd since, but I think that's what it was. There's been some sort of like discussion about it since, you know, that perhaps, yeah, which is a show, but then that's a very British thing. We don't like people to be outright winners. we prefer them to have got there by means that we can poke fun at them. It's just the sort of thing we do. But yeah, I'd come back. I mean, Gates, he's honestly, I think once he got over the initial thing, the first few episodes of Destination Truth, he did this like sub Philip Marlowe kind of voiceover, didn't he?
Mm.
And he was a bit wisecracking and a bit sort of like, I'm a private investigator looking at this, la, la, la. But as soon as he dropped that, he became a lot more engaging. And because it became clear that actually, no, people accepted him for being passionate about what he was interested in. And you're right, he scaffolds brilliantly. He says, okay, this is great. But then, and he notices other things. If he, even if he's looking for a Yeti and he spots a ghost, he will talk about the ghost.
Yeah.
He won't just ignore it, which too many of the other things will do. In fact, it's in the Arthur C. Clarke book, if I remember rightly, talking about the Yeti. And they show the usual sort of trail of prints, you know, going off up the mountain. And the usual Don Willans. And I still love Don Willans, who sounds a lot like Rich Freeman, actually, thinking about it. Never mind. Yeah, yeah. And there was a helicopter pilot, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
Who'd been taking Japanese tourists suddenly to photograph the mountains. And there'd been a Yeti, a really clear Yeti trail. And he'd said, can you photograph that? He said, no, we're not here to photograph that. We're here to photograph the mountains. And they weren't interested in it. Yes. And that's kind of the same sort of thing, isn't it? People just not interested in it. They're interested in what they're interested in. They don't give a monkeys about other possible mysterious stuff. So it's, I think it's some like Gates going, actually, hang on, this is worth looking at. You know, because finding Bigfoot wouldn't do that. You know, they could have a woman wander around in chains with her head under her arm. They'd ignore that because it's not Bigfoot. You know what I mean? It's sort of what they do, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is strange that those two seem to be the only two shows of this type, and I think they both get overlooked for whatever reasons, Stu, and yet, really, they are probably the only two shows, you know, as I said, Expedition X as well, which is the one he does with Jessica Chabot and Phil Torres as well.
Yes.
Doing a bit more sort of monstery, supernaturally things. Mind you, they did Ape Canyon and found evidence that something was there, which kind of puts a bit more credence to that shack being where people had said it was. But
yes. Yeah, there's a lot going on with Fred Beck in there.
Yes.
Because it's kind of like it's... I remember you've spoken about this, haven't you? You had somebody on speaking about it, I think, didn't you? About how it's... Yeah, there was a lot more going on there than we tend to think. And the very fact that the family, even though it's quite possible there's gold there, the family just go, no, sorry, we just are not interested. We don't want to know. You know, and that says a lot.
Yeah, they gave up their claim instantly after what happened. I think it was a silver mine?
Silver mine, that's it.
Yeah, and they gave up the claim and came back. But, yeah, he's a very strange story as well, because I know there's a very odd incident in his childhood. What did he lose? He lost a childhood toy and he met a strange person in the woods. And they said, don't worry about it, it's at home. And when he got home, it was there, but it was a different one. It's very odd. So he was clearly a man attracted to strange things. I forgot where I heard that. It might have been on Richard McLean Smith's show when he covered Ape Canyon a couple of years ago. And I think he brought that up. And I'd never heard that aspect of Beck's life before.
Well, that's funny enough, because, I mean, Randy Whitaker, another guy, about his I spoke to his friend for his necrologue in the FT. I spoke to his friend Tom Rothery, who'd known him all his life. And he said he was a finder of lost things. He could literally walk, and the example Tom gave me, Tom dropped his fraternity ring in a cornfield. He said, and Randy literally just walked into the field, stooped over and picked it up. Just said, that's the sort of, he could just do that. And that's a wild talent. But there's some people like that, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And you think, well, that's why you're a prospector, clearly.
Yes.
You know what I mean? He could do that. Yeah, damn right. And it makes it all the weirder that he gave up. Well, not weirder, I think. If you accept what he said happened, then I'd give up. I wouldn't care what was bloody there. I wouldn't go back. Mm. Good God, no. No,
definitely not. So where do you think we go from here in regards to 40 and television? Because obviously I know we set off as though we were saying things have got worse. But really, when you take a step back and look at it, they're probably as good as they've ever been, really. It's just the trouble is these days, there's so much stuff out there, it's very difficult to sort the wheat from the chaff when it comes to this kind of subject.
Exactly this, Paul. It's noise. There's an awful lot of noise. They said the signal-to-noise ratio is huge these days, I think. And the fact we've got so many channels, et cetera, and it's you know, it's funny because one of my other great interests is comedy, and I was looking at a retrospective of British sitcoms of the 70s and 80s. And we tend to think, oh, there was some really, really good. Yeah, there were, but there was some absolute tripe as well.
Yes.
But we've forgotten about them because they did. Natural selection means that they have fallen by the wayside now. So I think in the mid at the moment we're in that. If you like, if you want to use why not? Let's use an extended anthropological simile for this. If you like, we're in the middle at the moment of having Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons and Australopithecines and God knows what else all wandering around at the same time. And I think hopefully in 10, 15 years, the ones that remain and haven't died off will be the good ones, you know, which is the ones that deserve to continue, as it were. I mean, some of them things like ancient aliens will carry on ringing the same bell constantly. And I will watch Ancient Aliens, but I don't ever expect to learn anything from it, ever. Because the problem with Ancient Aliens, as entertaining as Tsoukalos's hair might be, is that they have one essential conceit to them, which is that they refuse to accept that something that's a small model of, say, a glider must be a model of something that's much, much bigger. They never accept the fact it could just be a model. Mm. It could just be a glider. You know, it's like a paper aeroplane. You make a paper aeroplane in a classroom when you're bored when you're 14. You're not building an F-111. No. You're building a model of one. You're building a paper aeroplane because it flies. And it's this thing about, oh, it must be a model of... No, why must it be? It might just be for its own sake, this thing. It doesn't have to be something that's a lot bigger. And I think once they accept the fact that just because something looks a bit like a fighter... But the thing is, you're going to throw something about which is going to fly. It's going to look like that. That's the whole point. It's the best possible design for it. Mm. You know, my dad was an aero engineer. You know what I mean? I know these things. It's kind of like, yeah, you're going to make something that's going to fly if you chuck off the top of a pyramid. You're going to make it delta wind because it's the easiest thing to build. It's because it's shaped like a bird. Yes, birds fly.
This is the thing as well. Why can't it just be a toy?
Exactly. Totally, you know, and they made really, you know, and also the other thing is, oh, look at these really ornate pictures, la, la, la. Yeah, okay, you're looking at Mayan pictures. Mayans ate cocaine. What do you want? You know what I mean? These people ate recreational drugs. You know what I mean? Come on, be fair. You know, the Nazca Lines, yeah, lovely, peyote grows there. What do you want? It's just people, let's draw some stuff. Yeah. Yes, do that, you know. And they said, well, you couldn't possibly see it from the sky. Well, look what Doug and Dave and a length of rope did in fields in England. And I've seen I'm sure you've seen crop circles up. So I've seen them up close. They are fabulous.
Yeah.
They didn't have, you know, they didn't even have drones back then. They didn't have anything like that. They just knew what they wanted to draw. And if you know how to draw out, mark out stuff, you can scale up hugely. So the Nazca lines, everybody goes, oh, they must be done from space. Well, no. The problem is this always demeans old civilizations, doesn't it?
Yes.
We tend to think, they didn't. No, they weren't. They were as intelligent as we are, if not more intelligent than we are, certainly more ingenious than we are. Mm-hmm. You know, we're as lazy as hell. If it keeps being said, doesn't it? If we got propelled back to the Stone Age for whatever reason now, we'd last 5 minutes.
Well, it is. It's one of those things, Stu, because people, I think, often, as you say, look back at those civilizations and think, oh, well, they must be stupid. But you think, well, no, because they didn't have the fallback position like we have of tools and technology at our fingertips. Because I've said this before, you say to anybody, oh, well, they were so uncivilized in those days. I said, well, tell me how TV works then. Explain to me how broadband works. And most people have no idea on a basic... Nope. They know where it is on a basic level. They know what it does, but they can't tell you how it works.
Nope, not a clue. And that's the thing. Or even a rough idea of how a car works. They have a rough idea. Other than that, more than the very basic mechanical, people have absolutely no idea. Hmm? You know, and you're right. We tend to think, oh, well, you know, they must have been... We always associate technological advance with intelligence. It's not that at all. It's us basically along for the ride. Other people have done all the hard work, you know, and it's a matter. But also we've got, this is something else that fascinates, and this, in fact, this goes back to The World Atlas of Mysteries, which was another great book of the 1970s by Francis Hitching. And he makes the point that we tend to get the timelines majorly scrambled. And it's a game, I can't remember what it's called, but we used to play it. And basically what you've got is you try to compare with our own British history or European history, where other things were happening and relative times. And it's things like, you know, the fact that Cleopatra lived closer to now than to when the pyramids were built.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. You think, oh, well, she was around when that. No, she wasn't. They were already as old as they were already 2,000 years old when she was born.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's kind of like, this is the thing. And things like, oh, the Mayans. And everybody thinks, well, the Mayans were around the same time as the Egyptians because of the pyramids. They weren't. Henry VIII met a Mayan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. It's they were mid, you know, they were medieval.
Yeah.
And we tell you, the Spanish, they conquistadors, they were all that kind of stuff. And we forget all this. And they came into contact with all these things. And the Native American tribes, First Nation tribes, came into contact with white men. Oh, they shunned the white men. No, they didn't. In a lot of cases, they took on the technology. They saw what was useful and took it on.
Yeah.
Like guns and stuff like that. Could see the use in guns. That's great. They took them on.
Yeah.
Still carried on their own ways. But we have this idea that whatever we have must infinitely be superior.
Mm.
It might not be. In fact, it might be rubbish. You know, if we did lose, if there was an electromagnetic pulse or a sun solar storm or something like that, and we lost our phone networks, Christ, we'd be screwed. You know what I mean? We'd be absolutely buggered, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
You know? In this country, at any rate, people in Borneo would be saying, oh, dear, a bit warm, isn't it? Let's carry on. It's like we'd be running around. I mean, we live in a society, Paul, where people ran the police because Kentucky Fried Chicken ran out of chicken.
Yes, yes.
You know, halcyon days. All us, I mean, our great superiority.
Well, yes. I mean, every year one of the local police forces will release some tape of people ringing up. I mean, I've heard people ringing the police to say that their radiator's leaking, Stu. So, you know, I'm not really sure, even in this modern era, that just because, I mean, it's like people who put questions on Facebook and you're like, why haven't you put that question into Google?
Google, exactly.
I mean, here we are still.
What? Mind, you might have said my mate Paul does it in another part, but half my friends are Paul. That's a mystery in itself. I don't know why they're going, everybody's called Paul. But because I can see the A4 Bath Road from here, and he lives in Bath, and he will put the question. It's become a tradition with us. He hasn't done it so much these days, but he used to put on everybody, what's it looking like? I said, hang on, I've got stairs. All right, it's looking pretty clear. Right, I'll set off now then. That was it. But and people, why does he ask you? It's because he's joking. For God's sake, he's got sat nav. He can see what it's actually looking like. We're having a laugh,
yeah.
You know. But there are, you're right, there's people just like, oh, what's the police helicopter up for? Us? So, well, how the hell are we supposed to know? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why? I don't know. But yeah, but coming back to where we were, wherever that was, yeah, what's the future? I don't know. I am hoping that, as you said, the more variety style ones do thrive a bit more. Because they do get, you know, they're intelligent. I've got Discovery Plus, and Discovery Plus has a huge amount of stuff on it, but quite a lot of them are very, very samey. I just watched the whole series of Alaskan Killer Bigfoot, which was interesting in itself. It was like an extent, you know, when Doug Hychek went to that lake in Ontario, you know, where they found, like, you know, there was a nail board, wasn't there, where something had stood on it.
Yeah, they did two episodes on that, didn't they? They did the first one and then they went back.
Yes, they went back, yeah. But this is like a whole, you know, a whole 10 episodes of something very similar. And it's one where, so say, a Bigfoot had, or Bigfeet, had chased an entire tribe away. Effectively, they had an industry there. You know, this was, I don't know, possibly pre-war. Probably it wasn't like back in the fields of antiquity. It was like maybe late 30s, maybe even after the war. It might have been to early 1950s. And effectively, it chased them all away. And they had a fish cannery and stuff like that there. And things had been destroyed. But some of the stuff they found was really, really intriguing. And they found basically a huge pressure cooker, which must have weighed half a ton easily, and it had been moved from where it should have been, and it was in the woods. I mean, it's not like you can't get a crane there, you can't, yeah, and it had been shifted, and that takes a lot of doing. At one point they're talking and a tree starts moving, and it's a proper tree being shaken properly. Now I was trying just the other day, funny enough, to uproot quite a small tree.
Yes.
In our back on. I was there for, I'm not a big bloke, I'm fairly strong, but it took me for fucking ever. And it was about a 4 foot tree and just really sort of like shaking it. This thing must have been a 25 foot job and I was being violently thrown about, you know. And they're watching this, and two of the guys were actual First Nation, and one of them was a professional hunter, and very level professional hunter. And they were looking at this thing, I have no idea what's doing that, which is great, because they're not going, it's a Bigfoot doing that. They're going, I have no idea what's doing that.
Yeah.
This is worrying. You know what I mean? And then they bring psychics in and stuff like that, and it gets a bit, you know, as it tends to do. But it's an interesting one, because other than that, it was quite sober, and it's good to see the sobriety coming back, you know. And in fact, I'd like to see Jack Osborne doing more stuff as well, because his stuff's actually quite good. Funny enough, you think, oh, yeah, it's all celebrity, but actually, no, Jack's pretty decent. I like his stuff.
Yeah.
And Shatner, I mean, Shatner's not well, is he? But I'd like him to continue doing what he's doing.
Well, he is, what is he, 92 now?
92, something like that. And apparently his health isn't fabulous, which is a bit of a problem. But then again, you see, if they should pull the In Search Of trick in that, because they had, as you know, they had Leonard Nimoy, and then Nimoy passed away. So they got the rebooted spot, which is Zachary Quinto to do it instead. Perhaps they should get Chris Pine to take over from, that's what they should do. I like Chris Pine, because he's quite funny as well. Yeah. He's quite similar to Shatner. He's got a bit about him, hasn't he? And he's quite funny.
Yeah.
I'd love it. I think that'd be great. But I think we need more of this stuff, and the British need to step up and start doing more of this stuff again. And in fact, Jonathan Ross doing his Myths and Mysteries thing, which is a bit tourist guide. But then again, I think we tend to look at it in a more critical way because we already know about this stuff.
Yes.
Occasionally, I will force my dear wife to watch something and just say, tell me what you think of this, because I already know it.
Yeah.
You know, some of the columns I write is stuff I know backwards. And I will say to her, look, would you mind just watching this and tell me whether you found this informative, whether it taught you anything? Because you and I will watch stuff and go, well, I know that. Yeah, or start complaining about it. Fresh eyes are a very important thing.
that is my worst. One of my worst points is my partner often will say this. She'll just say, just shut up.
Yeah.
Because I'll be going, that's wrong. No, that's not true. That's not right. Just watch it. And it's difficult, Stu. Like you say, when there's certain things and you know it back to front, or you know about certain... It is so frustrating for other people. We forget sometimes that they're not as obsessed with the weird as we are. And
they're not, honestly. I was sat on the sofa, and it was early morning, because I get up quite early. And so that's when I do a lot of my stuff, because I can only actually get a lot of it. I like Discovery Plus and stuff. I can only really get it downstairs on our big one, like, you know, for various reasons. So I'll sit there, and that's when I'll watch it. I'll do my columns early in the morning, because there's no other distractions. And I was sat there and I was watching, and it was something about the Patterson Gimlin film. And I was watching it, and there was Patty walking around. And my wife literally came down. She got up at that point. She walked. She came downstairs. There she was in her dressing gown. She walked in the living room, looked at the telly, and she literally went, oh, for Christ. And walked out again. It was just, oh, not again.
Yes.
Will you leave it alone? I can't.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed.
Yeah.
I admit it.
So, I mean, obviously, since you've been doing the column in the 14 times, is there anything that you've discovered or rediscovered, Stu, that you think is a gem? As we said, there's so much noise out there. I mean, we've touched on some of the ones. I mean, obviously, the rebooted In Search Of. I thought the first season was brilliant. The second one seemed to really sort of go off the rails.
It did, didn't it? It kind of lost it. And if it could capture what it had in the first one. The thing, one of the ones I discovered that I really was impressed with was one called Lore, which is, oh, I'm trying to think where it's available. You can get it.
Oh, it's on Quest Prime.
Yes. Lore is fabulous. Lore is great because it takes folklore and it looks, the way it does it, every episode is different. And it will take a slightly different view and a slightly different way of doing it. So my favourite of the lot is about werewolves, right? It covers the story of Peter Stubb. In Germany, you know, back in the whatever it was, 16th century. But the way it does it largely through lino cut. And it's got that very medieval feel to it as a result.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got live action as well, and it's got proper exposition, it's got a proper discussion of it. But the fact that it's done by a folklorist, it's not done by some sort of like producer. It's done by a folklorist who understands the context
yes
more than anything else. And And it's just done brilliantly. And the more gory bits are then revert to the liner cut. So it's not, you know, but then there's other episodes where they do it almost like in German expressionism.
Yeah.
And it's just so, and it's almost, one of it goes almost into full on Fritz Lang. And, but it's perfect. And it's a beautiful, beautifully made thing. And nobody seems to know about it. And I actually reviewed it and said, look, you know, watch this. This is absolutely fabulous. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of thing we need to look at, I think.
Yeah.
But there's a few of them quite good. And I'll tell you what, for the show notes, I'll chuck you over some of the titles.
Yeah.
But there's some of them which are genuinely good. They are thoughtful and they give it some time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and of course, always, I've always said Paranormal Witness is one of the better ones.
Yes.
Paranormal Witness is extremely good. Mm-hmm. Because it's the people giving their own testimony. Yeah. Unhysterically.
Yep.
And that's always worth watching. And of course, Monster Quest.
Yes.
Doug's stuff is good.
Yeah. The classic. You know?
Oh, absolutely, you know, and it's classics to the watching. And okay, I know he's, you know, you've spoken to him and I've spoken to him through whatever, but, you know, he's another honest broker. He's like, you know, he's like yourself. He wants to find the truth.
Yes.
But he's not going to let the truth completely steamroller reason, which is an important thing.
Absolutely.
You know, which is the way you've got to be with these kind of things. But I think it's, I mean, you know, and again, I think it's good to see that, looking at things like Shatner and so forth, that sci-fi is still feeding into it. And I think so long as, especially as sci-fi is getting quite strong again, sci-fi and Fortuynism do kind of run parallel. So when there's sci-fi, because it expands the idea of what people can expect and what people will entertain as possible, I think that helps Fortuynism as well, provided Fortuynism doesn't get too wild in the meantime. You know, I think that's the important thing. But yeah, it's fun. I like it. It's good to do. I'm sorry I've been even more rambling than normal, but as I said, you can blame the cold meds for that.
I'll let you off, Stu. I mean, it is one of those things. I think these days, as we were both laughing at it ourselves, we can be too critical, I think, because of our love of the subject. And sometimes it's nice to just sit back and enjoy something. I have to say, I kind of just watched Spooked Scotland last year. I watched that with no preconceived ideas or anything. Obviously, yeah. I was aware of Evelyn Hollow through her work on the Battersea Poltergeist and Uncanny on BBC Radio. Mm. So I watched that. I quite enjoyed it, really, primarily because they went to a lot of places I wasn't aware of in Scotland.
Yes.
It made a nice change. As we say, Shatner still surprises us, as does Josh Gates. I know The Unexplained's coming back again for another season. I mean, it would be good for something else to start filling the gaps in, because, as we say, occasionally, other than the odd special that they do over here, we don't get anything on our mainstream TVs. And I think sometimes it falls down to Prime and Netflix and the ones. And obviously, you look at how successful... I mean, this is the odd thing about all this, is that so many people will go on about Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah.
But that was exactly the same kind of problem I used to have when I was a kid watching some of that, that there'd be one really interesting part of it and then there'd be 40 minutes of murders and I'd be like, right, okay.
Yeah.
But it's something I now appreciate more than I did as a teenager watching it for the first time. The reboot of that has been a phenomenal success.
Yeah.
And I think it's a far better version of it, and it is focusing on really strange things still. It seems to be the only major show out there. I mean, obviously we've had ghosts, we've had the Navajo police unit, we've had the UFO episode as well, so it's still pushing the boundaries in regards to what it's doing. I personally think it's the best version of it, the new one.
I think it's more sure of itself.
Yes.
It's not a case of, oh, God, are we going to get ratings here? I think it's established itself enough that it can do it. And as long as it treats things equally soberly as the way it always has done, I think that's the thing. I think humility is the main watchword with all of these things. You know, they're not saying, we've got Revelation. Well, la, la, la. It's what we were saying earlier on, wasn't it, about, you know, I think the days of the shock jock style thing are dead. You know, that we're seeing less and less of the, we got this, we're going to live, this, proof. People aren't interested in that anymore. They want a bit more time. They want to see some evidence. They want to hear some testimony. And they want to hear it in a way that's calm and collected, and a way that will say, well, that could be a tree stump. Let's look at it a bit closer, you know, and stuff like that. And that's what people actually treat your audience with a degree of respect.
Yes.
You know, and basically credit them some intelligence and some critical thinking. Yeah. And people will reward that, which is why the X-Files did it so well. The X-Files didn't treat their audience like idiots.
Yeah.
You know, and people go, well, why has there been nothing like the X-Files? Well, it's because they don't, you know, it's very easy to lurch into Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
Effectively, you know, apart from Mountain Monsters, which was Stop the Pigeon from the beginning. The ridiculous, and trying to drop anvils from biplanes onto Bigfoot ain't going to work. You know, it's very expensive to put together that program. But as somebody pointed out not long ago, if you watch it closely, you can see most of the time the guns aren't loaded for a start.
Mm.
So, you know, it's never, that was never, ever genuine.
Mm.
But it might have been the first couple of episodes, and it was just how expensive it is to build a giant magnetic steel cage.
Yes.
So let's instead, let's just run around the woods making noises, you know, and add a narrative. And it's always the kiss of death when they start adding a narrative into it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, there's a spirit native guide. Oh God, here we go. You've run out of material, haven't you? There we go. Oh yeah. But I think we just need the calm and quiet and intelligent, because I think the audience is ripe for it, you know. And you watch something like, you know, if you look at some of the most compulsive programs lately, I mean, things like The Last of Us and things like The Walking Dead, to give two examples, they're very similar, obviously. But if you imagine doing that with I don't know, aliens, imagine doing that with Bigfoot, imagine doing that with something like that, you know. I remember somebody suggested ages and ages back, the Planet of the Apes, the Battle of the Planet of the Apes would be fabulous if they had just turned up and said, oh, we've made contact with the Sasquatch. It's just, that would have been a game changer, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And just see them coming out of the woods. They're all in the Pacific Northwest. We can already accept the fact that they're speaking chimpanzees and gorillas.
Yeah.
Might as well put a Sasquatch in there as well.
Yeah.
That would have been brilliant.
It would. That would be something perhaps to say for the reboot of it, no doubt, yeah, down the line, Stu.
Which no doubt that there will be, because, I mean, there hasn't been a film for at least 5 or 6 years. They need to reboot it pretty soon, don't they? Reboots get quicker and quicker all the damn time, don't they? You know.
Indeed. Honestly, they do. Indeed they do.
They absolutely do.
Well, my friend, thank you so much for your conversation. We've covered as many topics as always. Even ones I didn't even consider before we started. As
normal.
So, where can everybody read your normal column and anything else in the pipeline, sir?
Oh, the FT, yes, it's I share a bunk, as it were, with the Reverend Peter Laws. So he's got the bottom half of the page doing film reviews, and I've got the top half of the page being the couch potato. Or as they put me there, they described me in the Stephen Volk interview, I'm the coach potato, which is bloody better. So I'm the coach stroke couch potato. So yeah, now regularly in the FT. I've got a lot more FT articles coming up. I should really get on and finish them. There's quite a lot of FT stuff starting. FT forums, so the 14 forums, are doing really well. I've been neglecting them a bit recently, but I'm back on there a bit more. And there's some really good conversations happening on there at the moment. And I'm on chapter 6 of my book now. I was on chapter 5.5 last time I spoke to you. So in 9 months, I've written 500 words. So I'm doing all right.
Good. So forward progress. Onwards is forward progress, too.
Absolutely, you know. I don't know. I'll tell you what, though. I've made sure I've clouded everything this time. I lost half a dozen reviews not long ago because I didn't cloud them, and then my laptop died. And it's just, oh, God, no. You know, when go to that thing where you can kind of remember what you wrote, but it's just, oh, God, have I got to really write Help My House Is Haunted with Martin bloody Boss's Face Off Holmes Under the Hammer again? Which is in the most recent review. That's in this month's FT. And I'm not very kind about it because I was in a bad mood.
Well, having watched that programme, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
As always, my friend, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time and your trouble and your conversation, as always. I look forward to your regular columns, and I look forward to the next time we speak. You take care. Thank you for joining me.
You do the same, pal. I'll see you really soon, okay? You look after yourself. Cheers, man.